Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Billboard.com Pop Shop Podcast. My name is Keith Caulfield, and I am the co-director of charts at Billboard. Joining me, as always, is the fabulous Billboard.com senior editor, Katie Atkinson.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing quite well. How about yourself?
I am Jim Dandy.
Jim Dandy.
Jim Dandy. Mm-hmm. Jim Dandy. I'm Kim Dandy. I'm Lim Dandy. Daniel Day Kim Dandy.
Sure.
Sure. Anyway, the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast is your one-stop shop for all things pop on Billboard's weekly charts. In addition, you can always count on a lively discussion about things that rhyme with Kim. the week's big pop news, fun chart stats and stories, and guest interviews with music stars and folks from the world of pop. This week, the show is directed by you, our fabulous listeners. You asked and we answered. Indeed, it's another Ask the Pop Shop edition of the show. We asked you on Twitter and Facebook to submit any burning questions you had about charts or just music in general, and we'll be answering those during the show today. Plus, of course, we've got a chart stat of the week about a band that topped the Billboard 200 25 years ago this week. In addition to all of that, we have an interview with Hozier.
Yeah, he actually stopped by the office to talk about his new song, Better Love, from the Legend of Tarzan soundtrack, and much more, so definitely stick around for that.
But first, before we get started, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe to the show on iTunes so you won't miss an episode, and give us a rating or review while you're at it. If you have any questions for us, feel free to tweet us at Keith_Caulfield or KT Atkinson. And if you'd like to explore more podcasts from the world of Billboard, visit itunes.com/billboardpodcasts. So let's get right into this.
Yes.
Ask the Pop Shop.
Got lots of responses. We picked our favorite ones and the most popular ones.
Yeah, and we canvassed people on Twitter. And frankly, I actually canvassed people in like folks that I knew within the industry.
We have some insider questions.
Yeah, I asked my Facebook acquaintances and friends, who some are just music geeks, some are people that actually work in the industry. So that gives us a kind of different a different gaggle of questions.
Well, I like it. You've done a real sample of society here.
Yeah. So you start with the first one here.
Yeah, the first one's from Mike Killian, who came to us from Twitter at MDKillian954. He asked a very fun question. He said, can you replace the vocalist of any band, past or present, with the diva of your choice?
Mm.
That is a very fun Pop Shop question.
Diva questions. Gotta love those diva questions. I was thinking, because I was thinking about this beforehand, because it's kind of like a question like this is a sort of a deep thought question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, what if like the Revolution or the Commodores was fronted by say Chaka Khan?
Oh, yeah.
That'd be cool.
Yes.
I
took a few notes, too.
Okay.
I think that because of the band question, I was thinking, very rock.
Yeah.
So then I was kind of trying to think of women who have, really powerhouse rock voices.
Yeah.
And so I came up with three that I thought all have those kind of voices. So my first one I came up with was Kelly Clarkson. Who there's a lot of bands I think she could front, but I feel like lately she has really been embraced by the country side of things. I thought Rascal Flatts. What if Kelly Clarkson sang all of Rascal Flatts songs?
Hmm.
I would totally pay for that show.
Well, speaking of powerhouse divas, powerhouse vocal divas, Pat Benatar, iconic rock legend, female vocalist in general, who basically has an operatic rock voice. What if she fronted Van Halen?
What if indeed?
What if she was singing Hot for Teacher?
And they can't seem to get along very well with their lead singers, so might as well just plug Pat Benatar.
I think after when David Lee Roth departed the group in 84 or 85, I think there was talk about them having a woman join the band.
That would have been really cool.
I want to say it was Patti Smith, not like Patti Smythe.
Patti
Smith from the 70s, but Patti Smythe.
Yes, okay.
It is Smythe, right?
I don't know if that's how it's pronounced.
The woman from Scandal.
Yeah, yes.
So that was another one I thought
of. Okay, I came up with Pink.
Oh, well, geez.
And
okay.
I feel like, once again, actually, Van Halen, I would go for that.
Sure.
I wrote down Bon Jovi.
Ooh.
So I thought that would be kind of awesome.
Like You Give Love a Bad Name, as sung by Pink.
Totally.
Bad Medicine.
Anything with bad in the title.
Anything, you have a bad medicine. I don't think there's any other bad Bon Jovi songs.
Okay, so that's probably.
Maybe there could be. I don't know. Who else? Well, like, let's think of like sort of a traditional pop diva.
I think that's what I was struggling with, actually. Like a Mariah, right, or Christina. Like, where would you put
that?
Well,
Christina does have like
Christina, she could do rock.
Yeah, I mean, Christina certainly could. I mean, I think Mariah could actually, like.
We've just never seen it. I think she probably could do it, too. She'd probably do anything she damn well feels like doing.
She could. She's covered Def Leppard before.
Oh, okay.
Bringing on the Heartbreak.
Yeah. That's like a power ballad.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Can't Live If Living Is Without You, isn't that a Harry Nilsson song originally?
True.
Like, that song is, I mean, killer. She could totally do a rock ballad.
What else? Like, could, you know, Madonna used to actually be in a band.
Really?
Back in the early 80s, she was in the Breakfast Club.
What about some more modern bands? Like, could like Ariana Grande step in with like Kings of Leon? I'm just trying to think of an example of like a really powerful.
Well, these are you know, kind of these. This is kind of like how the Grammys book the show each
That's
year.
That's true.
Where they put unlikely mashups together, mm-hmm, of things that work that you never really thought of, and then maybe on paper it doesn't seem like it's the perfect thing, but then, mm-hmm, it actually works really well. And that's why sometimes these curveball collaborations, you wouldn't think they'd make sense, but sometimes, especially now, you know, music is music, and a, mm-hmm, lot of these artists all love one another and love each
actually,
other.
Demi Lovato did a duet with Fall Out Boy on their most recent album. I could totally see her just stepping in for Patrick Stump and singing his vocals,
yeah,
for some Fall Out Boy songs.
Powerhouse vocals,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Well, I think those are some good ideas.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I think it's a great question, Mike.
Yeah. Well, this one is from Daniel Meyer Conroy via Facebook, pal of mine. He asks, what album release in the rest of the year is expected to have the highest first week sales?
We've already gone through Beyonce and Drake and Kanye this year, which are all three pretty massive albums.
Things that you would typically expect.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, the problem is a lot of these albums tend to be surprises.
Right.
We don't really know when they're going to magically
appear. In January we wouldn't have known Lemonade was coming in April. Yeah.
Yeah, we weren't. So I think if Jay-Z drops an album,
mm-hmm,
which seems to have been rumored now for years, you know,
It's been a while.
I think that is certainly a likely contender, but it'll be interesting because most likely he'll probably do some sort of interesting rollout of the album.
Like he did last time, it just showed up on your Samsung phone.
Yes. So there could be that. Taylor Swift, if she stays to her schedule, she should drop an album by the end of the year if she follows how she's normally, her normal release pattern.
But we have heard from her that she wanted to make herself scarce for a while, and she seems to be doing that now professionally, so.
True. I feel like, though, her vacations are, you know, like.
Working vacations?
Yeah, like she's, because when we interviewed her at the American Music Awards.
Before 1989?
Yeah, and that was like the year before. And she's like, I already have like 8 songs done or whatever it was.
1989 still feels new to me, but you're right if she sticks with her traditional schedule.
Now, granted, 1989 was a much larger album for her, but still, I feel like she still had a bunch of singles from it.
Mm-hmm.
It still had a big world tour behind it. You know, but maybe she feels like, I just need to decompress and take a longer break and kind of regroup and, like, where am I going to go forward with,
mm-hmm,
my sound? So I think Taylor and Jay-Z are the obvious ones. You know, if there could be some crazy thing that we're not thinking of, like, what if, you know, I'm trying to think of, like, who could do, like, a Christmas album that would kind of, like, break the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if Adele decides to drop a Christmas album.
I mean, like, we were surprised by Drake and Future putting a project out like that. Like,
yeah.
What if there's some weird collaboration thing that comes out, too, like, that we don't know about?
Like, but it has to be, and, you know, who would have thought? I mean, I think anything Drake touches.
Yeah.
Drake could just drop another mixtape.
Yeah.
Just because Drake can kind of do whatever he wants right now.
This is true.
You know, maybe Ed Sheeran drops a surprise,
mm-hmm,
like, an album, because he's been kind of on the down low.
He also wanted to take a pause.
And he really has.
From public life,
like,
yeah.
He disconnected from social media.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like, bye. I'm out. I mean, I think any of those folks would be big. I think, you know, certainly maybe when Luke Bryan's album comes out, I think,
mm-hmm,
he has a new EP or album coming out maybe later this year. That'll be huge.
He has a farm tour EP coming out, but that's probably not going to be, you know, set the world on fire.
Yeah.
Maybe it will.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe it'll just be sort of the preamble to whatever the next album,
mm-hmm,
is.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's some thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do we got next here?
Well, next up, we have a few questions about Miss Britney Jean Spears. We have one from Adam Price, who is at AdamPrice04 on Twitter. How do you think Britney's singles/album will do this next era? And kind of relatedly, Austin from Twitter, at Austin A. Graham. Where's that Britney album?
Where's the Britney album?
Basically a two-parter of when's the album coming and how will it do?
Well, if we knew when the album was coming, we would have reported that.
Yes.
But we assume it's coming this year.
So, yeah. I mean, maybe that's the one that's going to do really well this year. We'll find out.
We'll find out.
I asked Keith to grab some stats about her last few albums to kind of see how she's done with her previous albums. Britney Jean is her last album. And it debuted and peaked at number 4.
On the Billboard 200.
And it spent 11 weeks on the chart, which is the fewest that she spent on the chart with a studio album.
Yeah.
So then we look at what came before it, which was Femme Fatale. And it, well, how did it do on the Billboard 200?
Well,
do you know?
It debuted at number one. And it spent 33 weeks on the chart.
Okay.
So it, clearly already a huge difference in terms of the reception.
The big thing is to look at probably the songs, the singles that came from those albums, too. So with Britney Jean, Work Bitch and Perfume were the singles. On Femme Fatale, you had Hold It Against Me, Till the World Ends, and I Want to Go, which were all
top
really
tens.
Big Hot 100 hits. Yeah, top 10 Hot 100 hits.
All three of them went top 10. Hold It Against Me went to number one. Whereas on Britney Jean, neither one of those, Work Bitch or Perfume, reached the top 10.
So to me, what this says is not that Britney is necessarily going to go on a downward trajectory. It says to me that it all depends on the songs and the singles that she comes out with the next album, because she clearly can make a hit song in her sleep. I mean, like, she's released so many in her career and people still are just obsessed with her.
I think, and you know, I mean, Work Bitch did not work.
It just wasn't
as successful as the level that Britney and her fans and the industry is used to, and she could not come back from that with the subsequent singles. It just didn't work. Whereas someone like Sia, who we talked about in a recent episode,
was able to rebound with Cheap Thrills
after Alive didn't work. I mean, they tried with Perfume, but it just wasn't clicking. And then, you know, she regrouped and came back with a standalone single, Pretty Girls, with Iggy Azalea, that had, like, a moment where it was really hot, and then it quickly went away. So, you know,
it's going to be all about the singles.
The single.
100%.
It's going to be the single, and if it connects, and if it connects and it works, then expect an album to be shortly following. And if it doesn't necessarily work, then they'll probably keep working on that album and try to figure out what is the right map to where they're going to take her.
And, you know, she'll just keep killing Vegas.
Yeah, the Vegas show, man. I mean, that Billboard Music Awards performance,
10 minutes of just, like, her career wrapped up into a bundle.
Hairography,
dancing.
She looked amazing. The dancing.
Yes.
Like, she was doing the cartwheel thing. I mean, it's that.
Never count out Britney Spears is the moral of this story.
Next question is actually from Michael Anderson, who friend of mine on Facebook and Twitter. What artists have had the most top 10 albums without a top 10 Hot 100 hit?
Ooh, I like that question.
Now, he has a vested interest in this, and you'll find out. You'll find out in a moment. The answer actually is the Kidz Bop Kids.
Oh my goodness.
And truth be told, Michael actually works for Razor and Tie and Kidz Bop.
Okay.
And he helps. He actually
kind of. He might have known the answer to this one.
I told him, I'm like, I think you know the answer. He's like, yeah, but I'm kind of interested to hear about the other acts below Kidz Bop.
Okay. And I feel like the rest of our audience is probably really surprised to hear that.
Yeah, well, they're probably surprised that Kidz Bop Kids have had so many top 10 albums. They've had 23 top 10 albums. And people might wonder, well, how is Kidz Bop Kids really a group? And it's tricky. They were effectively a studio group for like the first like more than a dozen, 15 or something albums. I mean, or 20. It was ridiculous. And they were all anonymous vocalists. I don't even know if they were named in the liner notes. And more recently, like in the past, like probably like, I don't know, 8-10 albums maybe, they've actually had name, like children and teens that they've recruited. They go on tour now. They actually have their own like Twitter accounts and social media presences.
So it's kind of like Menudo, where they're, you kind of age out of it.
Yes. They are Menudoing the Kidz Bop because they've expanded it to become like an identifiable brand. So
I'm going
to
remember this day where Menudo was used as a verb on the Pop Shop.
They're
Menudoing. Really like
well, after Kidz Bop, it's actually George Strait.
Oh.
He's had 20 top 10 albums on the Billboard 200, but not a single top 10 single. On the Billboard Hot 100. He's a country superstar and had a zillion number ones on the country chart, but he's never had a pop crossover hit
because
on the Hot 100.
He is country to the core. Like, yes. That's not going to get played on pop radio. Or,
no.
Yeah.
He's never had, like, a fluke, like Lady Antebellum Needs You Now hit.
Or Florida Georgia Line, Cruise.
Or
yeah.
Lone Stars.
Amazing.
Amazed.
Amazed.
He was amazed, yeah. Or a Dolly Parton or a Kenny Rogers. He just hasn't had that happen,
mm-hmm.
but that does not take away any of his success.
Oh, yeah.
By any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
So there,
Kidz Bop Kids and George Strait.
Man, that George Strait could front the Kidz Bop Kids. That would be the supergroup
joint tour.
Yeah, there you go. It's the Kidz Bop Country Kids. What's next?
Next up, we have a question from Mark Greeno,
friend of mine on Facebook,
friend of Keith's. I'm gonna enlist my friends next.
Yeah,
time.
You should.
My family's going to ask all the next questions.
I wasn't completely stacking the deck here, but you know, everyone had an equal shot at this.
I'm sure our audience is going to be very interested in the answer to this one. How will Zayn's cancellation of a recent concert due to anxiety affect his career opportunities going forward?
He recently, I think it was Capital FM, mm-hmm. was a big radio station
in
the
UK,
and they had a big like stadium radio show, mm-hmm. and he
it might
canceled
have even
the last
been
minute.
Like Wembley, right?
It
was a big venue.
Big venue.
And a lot of people were there to see Zayn.
Yeah. And he canceled, I think, as the show was in progress.
Yeah, they put it up like on the screens at the venue. And according to people who were there on Twitter, like there was like an exodus. Like a lot of people left when they found out Zayn was not performing. And there were other artists performing there, but like there were people there for Zayn. Because he hasn't done a lot of live shows as a solo artist yet. Or maybe... any? I mean, he's done live TV
he's
performances.
He's done TV performances.
Yeah. Now I'm wondering about that. But yeah, he wrote a really personal message to his fans after that, saying that he's struggled with anxiety his entire career. And I think he's acknowledged that having four other guys next to him when he was in One Direction kind of took the pressure, the spotlight off of him, you know, so he didn't have to feel all of that on himself. But as a solo artist, all eyes are on him the entire time. And it sounds like the anxiety got the best of him on that occasion.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, too. I didn't know about what he had explicitly said with regards to the One Direction.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, you've played stadiums before. And how is this different? I'm like, well, that's a very distinct difference. If you're there supported with four of your friends, you know, even despite all of their differences that they had and, you know, he departed the group, they still had that bond of being together on stage. And if he was having like a moment of like panic, he could probably look over at Liam or Harry and they could be like wink at him or look at him and be like, it's all right, we got this.
Or like when it's not his solo part, kind of like run off to the back area of the stage behind the drummer or whatever, like take a moment and no one's wondering what's up because the music goes on, you know?
I mean, just we have to sort of step back and think, you know, these are human beings who are expected somehow to stand in front of like 50,000 people and entertain them, and it's all on you.
And even though like they've had so much success, he has had so much success, he really did start as just a normal kid who auditioned for a show, and then it's like this runaway train took off.
Yeah.
So it's like he knew he was a great singer and wanted to be a musician. That decision was made by auditioning for X Factor, but was the decision made for like worldwide, massive, constant spotlight fame? Like when he was, 17 or whatever, when he auditioned?
Yeah.
So it's you know, if he's always had like a little bit of anxiety and it's just grown and it's grown, I can't even imagine how complicated and difficult that is.
I think this might be a bump in the road.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to take opportunities away from him. He's such a massive star and his solo music has done so well so far.
Well, I think our last question will be one where, we got a lot of questions about this person.
We have to talk about the woman of the hour on Twitter when we put the question out. This is her fans were vocal.
Some might say that they were on the verge of spammy.
Aggressively vocal.
They were aggressively vocal. Demi Lovato's fans had some questions. Specifically, could you please update her total U.S. sales? Could you please give us the total sales of Cool for the Summer? And yes.
I was just going to ask you, like, do you know why this is such a hot button Demi issue?
You know, I don't know.
Because it was so instant how it was like, we have an opportunity to ask Billboard a question, like, this is the one.
I'm unsure. I saw there was something where she, I think, was recently received a platinum plaque for, I think, an album or a song.
Okay.
A lot of these questions actually came from fans that were not in the United States, which I thought was interesting because they're asking for U.S. sales.
Specifically about U.S. sales.
So there must be something, hey, fans, don't overwhelm me, but one of you can maybe just tell us why you're super interested. That said, her total album sales in the United States are 2.29 million, according to Nielsen Music. Her most recent album, Confident, has sold 211,000 copies in the United States. Her total digital song sales, again, in the U.S. only, stand at 19.5 million downloads. And finally, her big hit from last year, which she also performed on the Billboard Music Awards this year, yes. Cool for the Summer, has sold 921,000 downloads. All of these sales are through the week ending June 16th, actually. There's your sales update.
Yeah.
On Ms. Lovato.
You wanted it? Here it is.
Here it is. And we appreciate the passion. Well, I think that was a fun Ask the Pop Shop.
Those were great questions.
Those were good questions. And thanks to the folks on Twitter and thanks to some of the folks I know on Facebook. And we hope to do this again soon and try to answer even more questions.
Yeah.
I think up next now it is our guest interview time.
Yes, our guest interview with Hozier. He actually came by the LA office to talk about his new song Better Love from the Legend of Tarzan soundtrack. And of course, we also talked about his breakout hit Take Me to Church and its success across Billboard's charts, rock charts, Hot 100, etc. And plus, we check in on what he has planned so far for his sophomore album, the follow-up to his 2014 album. So here is our interview with Hozier.
Lying to the purpose of the brute divine, but you are mine. Staring in her blackness at some distant star. The thrill of knowing how alone we are, unknown we are.
Hello, Hozier, and welcome to the Billboard Pop Shop Podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You know, you're here today because you just released the song Better Love from the Legend of Tarzan soundtrack.
Yes, yes.
It's a gorgeous, haunting ballad that it really builds up as it goes. And I was wondering, did you write this song for the movie specifically, or was it a song that you'd already been working on?
Yeah, no, not at all. No, it wasn't. It was kind of written, you know, I wrote it after our kind of first conversation with the filmmakers. So. And I had been on tour up until this point, and I hadn't been working on new music. I hadn't had a chance to work on new music. So I was very eager, and very eager to now to work on, you know, more stuff and further. But I think this was like the first song that I had a chance to kind of sit down and kind of wrap my head around and sink my teeth into.
Yeah.
After going on tour. So after coming off tour. So it was like literally the first week after LA. So it was, we had a conversation, and what was frightening, I suppose, was the deadline was so short, and so, and the song, you know, the song had to, you know, had to start from that point, kind of start from that point of influence, you know. So yeah, it was written specifically, I guess.
What was that process like? Did they give you a script or scenes to look at?
I saw an early edit of the film.
Okay.
I should say, yeah. So I saw an early edit, and just talked about it. Talked about the director and the composer, and it's an amazing team. You know, David Yates is the director. He's done some fantastic work. He's working on the upcoming Harry Potter film as well too at the moment. So he's very, very busy.
Composer. I'm sure.
Yeah. And composers, a guy called Rupert Gregson Williams, who's lovely.
So if they invited you to come work on Harry Potter, would you do that too?
I would. You know what you. you know what, you consider, you know, it's some, yeah, I mean, I will, like, to be honest, I'm going to take some quiet time now.
I think
this was a crazy project. So I'm thrilled, you know, it was really fun to do, but I'm looking forward to taking some quiet
time. A little break.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, love is right there in the title. So I'm assuming that, you know, your inspiration as far as Tarzan goes was kind of the love story.
It is a love song.
Yeah.
It's a love song. So it's a love song, and it's kind of, I suppose at the heart of the story is a love tale.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real adventurous film. But I kind of wanted the song to kind of resonate with that. And it's, and you know, the characters kind of go through a lot as well too. The film takes place in a very hostile environment. You
right.
know? So I wanted to kind of bring that somewhat into the song.
Okay. And you know, this is the first movie soundtrack you've worked on. Is that something that you would be interested in doing again, depending on the project?
Possibly. I feel like I'm a songwriter. So, you know, at the end of the day. So at the end of the day, I guess, I write songs. And I love doing it. So, you know, when an opportunity like this comes along, it's always a challenge. And I do like, you know, facing a challenge like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and kind of doing new things. I would love at some stage when the time was right to maybe, you know, score a film. To
yeah.
Score for a film. But, you know, everything would have to be right, I think. And
that's a lot of work, too.
It's a
I mean,
huge
composing.
Amount of, oh, my
yeah.
God. Yeah. Yeah. I have huge respect for composers. And, but yeah. Yeah. And the musically literate, let's say. So I had a lot of help, actually, that the orchestration on this song was composed by and arranged by Alex Ryan, who's my bass player.
Okay. Just, oh, wow.
Fantastic.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. He's a close friend and just an all-around dude.
Yeah. I feel like that trajectory happens a lot, though, if you think of, like, Danny Elfman going from Oingo Boingo in the 80s to becoming
yeah.
this film composer.
Jesus, yeah.
Yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah. I think, yeah. And he has such a unique, you know, he has, that's just that Danny Elfman kind
yeah.
of, you know, thing going on. But yeah, and he's yeah, maybe so, yeah,
there you
yeah,
go
yeah.
The future, the mm-hmm. what might be what your future holds. Mm-hmm. Did you kind of think about any of your favorite movie music when you were working on this at all?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yes and no. I think I have a lot of, yeah, obviously I have a lot of famous movie music, maybe a little bit in the production, I suppose. Like I'm a huge fan of people like Ennio Morricone and stuff like that. And, you know, obviously John Williams. But I think, you know, I wasn't in for this project. I was kind of outside of the score sort of,
right.
of the actual, you know, side of things. You know, this was very much a contemporary song. You know, the early discussions were, you know, that, you know, we're looking for a contemporary song, and I wanted to make sure it felt like it resonates with the film, but also it feels natural to myself, and it feels like natural. It feels like something that I could write,
right.
you know, and it feels like it's coming from me and coming from my voice.
Right, like inspired by the story, but not set in that period or that time,
I
basically.
Suppose so, yeah. I wouldn't be on the nose. It wouldn't be so on the nose in that the person singing the song is Tarzan himself.
Right. Maybe Alexander Skarsgård breaks into it during the movie.
You know what? I actually talked about that. And
that would be incredible.
I was one of my demands. And it was... Yeah.
Made sure that was in the contract.
Yeah,
like, I'll do
like,
it.
Yeah, I was like, I'll do it. Can we recast Margot Robbie?
Right.
Maybe I could fit it. I'd fit it in a great dress.
Sure,
I would
yeah.
really fill out a good
yeah.
dress. And
he's tall. You're tall. It would really work.
In those arms? You know, are you kidding me? Jesus.
I absolutely love it. And when did you film the video that went with it?
Okay. Only like 2 weeks ago.
No way.
Two or 3 weeks ago. That really.
They turned that around.
There's the pretty mysticism gone right there. And this was yeah. It really was a very kind of, you know, it was rushed in any way. You know, basically it was a short deadline, a very short deadline for me in the way I usually work. So it was kind of one of those things that I just said, look, we have three weeks to. You know, conceive of, to put a demo, to start recording if it's okay, to, you know, record that demo and then do another session in Abbey Road to put the orchestration on it, to mix it and master it. And literally it was like 3 or 4 weeks
Man.
Deadline. And then That is such a tight deadline. Yeah, and I don't know how, I've never worked in that regard.
Right.
I enjoyed the challenge, and it, you know, it was exciting. But and then there was the video that had to be done before that, you know. So the video is, there's a lot of footage from the film in it, and then the parts where I think the performance side of it is directed by a guy called Kevin Godley, mm-hmm. who's a fantastic director and musician also. But yeah, so that was done a couple of weeks ago in Dublin.
Well, and I saw your post on Twitter about when you were recording at Abbey Road, and I never would have thought that was this song because that was so quick.
Sneaky.
That's incredible. So, you know, this is the first new music that your fans have really gotten to hear since your 2014 debut album.
Yeah.
Were you conscious of that when you said yes? When you said yes to this project, were you conscious of that? You know, knowing that this would be like your first kind of musical statement since then?
I suppose so. In a way, because I've been on the road for so long, I've been on the road for 2.5 years. And so, yeah, wow. I released the album now at this stage. It's been 2.5 years since I unpacked the suitcase.
That's insane.
So... Yeah, the last album was released in late 2014, and I kind of feel like, you know, I've been working and promoting that album for about 2 years now, and so I haven't had a break and I haven't had time away, so I'm very, very eager to get working on the next album, but I really need some time to unwind and to take a break. So in a lot
live
of ways,
some life probably.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And so in that regard, I think I kind of saw this project as, I suppose it'll be the last thing people see of me for quite a while.
For a bit.
Yeah, for a bit. I won't say too long. But
sorry, everybody.
For a little bit. So, and it was nice because I don't know what shape and what feel and what sound the next album will take.
Right.
So it was nice to get involved in this project. Work again with Rob Kirwan, who was my producer of the last album, and kind of, you know, it's a song that could have belonged on the and I don't know, it could belong on the next album but working with the producer and exploring that again and working with Roy Doyle on drums and Alex Ryan, the bass player. It was just, I don't know, it was nice. I felt ready to do something.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it for a break, you know.
You say that now, but then maybe you'll just start writing things when you have that break maybe it'll all be three weeks in Abbey Road.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
You know, you made such a huge impact with your first album thanks to the global success of Take Me to Church. And since we're Billboard, we'll look at the charts there. The song hit number 2 on our Hot 100.
We always look at the charts.
We love the charts. I'm sure artists have a love-hate relationship with the charts.
The magazine is called Billboard. Yeah. Don't look at it. No. Don't look at the Billboard charts, Billboard.
Just kidding. And it, of course, topped our Hot Rock songs. And actually, when I was researching for this interview, it was even on our dance club songs chart.
Isn't that crazy?
It's incredible.
Yeah. I was very fortunate.
Can you kind of talk about, you know, what doors that success really opened up and the opportunities that it brought you?
Yeah. I'm still kind of figuring that out. And I keep... It's such an inadequate answer. But I think at the time I was so... You know, you're so... You know, if I could do it all again, maybe I'd think differently about it. But I was you're so wrapped up in it, and you're such in a state of just, you know, here's the next thing, and you're just go. You're literally every minute of every day is working towards. You're making a count, and you're doing 3 sessions a day, you know, 7 interviews, and then a performance, and then a meet and greet, and then you're kind of. Then you do it again the next day. So it was, I didn't allow myself, and in a way I'm glad I didn't allow myself to engage too much with the kind of the textual definitions of success,
right.
You know what I mean, or the numerical definitions of success. And I'm like, yeah, the doors had opened. I mean, obviously it was such an honor to be nominated for, you know, say, you know, for the Billboard Awards, for, you know, a Grammy. You know, I came up with 2. That is just beyond, like, it was just beyond kind of any expectation I would have had
right.
for my debut album, hands down. So I'm just thrilled, and to meet the people that I've met, the artists that I've met, and to be able to kind of share I just have that experience. It blows me away. I think because it was a real kind of do-it-yourself project to begin with, I think if anything, I hope that people are encouraged that if I could do this, I think there's a lot of talent out there that could do something similar.
Yeah.
You know, the charts are a daunting thing, and it's very, very, it feels very, very hard for a new artist to to feel like they will ever get their music on radio, because, you know, those avenues sometimes feel like they're a little bit closed, yeah. You know. So I don't know. And just through streaming, through sharing kind of platforms and discovery platforms, my music got to people in a kind of a, you know, in a fairly, you know, just on the ground floor, you know, and was shared in that regard. And I was incredibly lucky. I think if I could do that, there's a lot of people who could.
Yeah.
As for the doors that opened for me, obviously, you know, it is fantastic and it's wonderful. But I want to maybe take a break, take a breather. I feel like, you know, one album is not a career. You know, one hit song, as amazing as it is not as such. But I want to be able to keep making music that people can enjoy.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take a break and work on the next album. I'm really excited.
You mentioned the Grammys. Your performance there with Annie Lennox was mm-hmm. epic. That's one of those, you know, pairings that might have seemed odd or whatever beforehand, but then the two of you, it was just like really magical. Take Me to Church and I Put a Spell on You. How did that all come together?
She is dynamite. She is just a legend. I think it came together. So the first I heard was like, you know, kind of clocking through and saying, hey, how would you feel about, you know, sharing the stage with Annie Lennox if you were performing at the Grammys? I was like, what? You know, a few backflips later, I'm like, yeah, of course, yeah. I would love to. And she is, you know, just, you know, she's just an incredible performer, just an incredible presence. And so, it was actually the decision of a producer with the Grammys called Ken Ulrich, who, you know, puts together a lot of these duets.
Yeah.
And I met her in LA a few days before the Grammys, and we kind of ran over the idea. I think initially we weren't sure. She had an album out called Nostalgia, which was nominated for a Grammy. It was like kind of classic R&B songs.
Mm-hmm.
But it really worked because, you know, we just talked about it and we kind of riffed around with it. And, you know, I think we had one day a rehearsal together and I think I took a lot away from that experience with her, but also, you know, being as green as I was, just sharing the stage with her was a dream and you know, terrifying dream, but like just a wonderful one at the same time. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. She's amazing. She is.
You know, you kind of mentioned that you're taking a pause before you get back into things.
Yeah.
You mentioned also that you know, such a DIY kind of album process. Do you kind of want to see if you can get back to that
yes.
for the second album?
Totally. Totally. So now part of it is through necessity of just being an awful control freak. But I think some of it is just I was comfortable the way I did the first album. It was the first time I was writing music from a younger age and recording different projects. But I think it was the first time I was ever happy with my own music and happy with the process. And that's why I waited until I was 23 before I released music, I think. Fully ready to release music until I was 23. And then, so I want to do that again. So
yeah.
I was tempted, like, I love coming to LA. It's such a beautiful place.
Oh, I'm glad you like it. Not everyone likes it.
I do. At first, I was confused by the place.
Sure.
I didn't know how. It's so big. It's so vast. It's the same with, and it's not like an immediate city. Like, you can land in New York and walk down a few blocks, and everything is immediately, boom, like, it's right there in front of your
yes.
face. LA is a place that takes a bit more time.
A little discovery.
Yeah, totally. So the more I come to LA, the more I see what's amazing about it. But I'm tempted to do the bad thing and just, you know, move into the city and enjoy myself. But a bit too much. No, I'm joking. I'm going to move into the countryside and do exactly as I did on the first album. Just a bit of headspace and just take my time with it.
Back in Ireland, then?
Back in Ireland, yeah.
I just visited for the first time. It's incredible there.
Where'd you go?
I went to Dublin and to Galway City.
Nicely done.
It was just absolutely...
Nicely done.
Yeah.
Okay, did you have fun?
Oh, my goodness. So much fun.
Okay.
Yes. Actually, my maiden name is Byrne, Byrne. So
you
were probably related somehow.
Yeah.
So it was really nice. I felt very like at home there, actually.
So Byrne, is your family from, would be from Dublin?
I have no idea. I don't know like my ancestry at all. My dad's family was the Byrne side. And yeah.
A lot of Byrnes in Wicklow.
So yeah?
In Dublin, Wicklow area.
Okay. And that's where you're from, right?
Yeah.
I can't wait to go back.
That's cool.
Adored it.
Yeah, we could be related.
Probably.
Yeah.
You know, and finally, this interview happens to be on a very big political day. The UK voted to leave the European Union, and you're from Ireland, which is not part of the UK, but it's still a huge deal for European politics.
Oh, stop.
I'm just curious.
Oh, Jesus.
About how you felt about this, or whether it was a surprise to you.
I think we all have the, we all run the risk of thinking that people have common sense sometimes. I don't know. I think it'll be okay. Look, I'm not going to add to the doom and gloom of today, because I think there's enough of that going on. And it was doom and gloom that got us into this kind of demagoguery and this kind of into this, you know, referendum result. So my heart breaks. It was around, you know, 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock in the morning. I was just gobsmacked. Like, because, you know, the Remain was ahead by a few points, and then it just swung. And like the markets went up, and then like what kills me is that it's the younger generation that is going to suffer.
Right,
it's going to suffer from this. And the majority were, you know, older folks. This, and what kills me is that it's not a good look. It's not pretty. A lot of the Leave campaign, you know, was centered around a fairly, you know, just, you know, essentially, you know, sometimes a thinly veiled xenophobia, you know, just control our own borders, and it's not a good look. And I don't think it represents Britain. I don't think it represents the UK, you know, all too well. It breaks my heart for my generation in Britain who, you know, who are going to suffer this. And again, I just think it's a massive betrayal of that generation, huge betrayal. It's a betrayal and my heart breaks for the people in Scotland as well too, and people in, like, it complicates matters greatly in Ireland, and greatly, you know, for the border and stuff like that and up north. So I don't know, I can't comment on it. At the end of the day, we can talk forever about it. Britain's not going to sink. Like, it's, you know, life will go on. It's not, nothing's going to change immediately. Life will go on. But I just think it was demagoguery. Like, I just think it was smoke, mirrors, and demagoguery that kind of got us into this. I don't know how it happened like it happened, but like, it will be okay. But I just, you know, anyone, I would just say anyone who voted to remain, you know, just keep fucking fighting the good fight, and, you know, and punish politicians for it, you know, if you can. Yeah.
Well, that is the most political that the Pop Shop podcast has ever gotten, but I really appreciate you commenting on that. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us, and we're looking forward to whatever the next chapter of music brings.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Every Sunday's getting more bleak, a fresh poison each week. We were born sick, you heard them say it. My church office.
Thank you so much to Hozier for stopping by. What a pleasure to have him actually in the office. Just a great dude all around.
I think I've interviewed him maybe like once or twice in, like,
so tall.
Very tall. and a very nice gentleman.
Oh, yes.
Well, now I think it is time for our chart stat of the week.
Yeah, I think so too.
Ooh, yay. and funny enough, this is actually related to an act that we mentioned early on in the show. 25 years ago this week, on the Billboard 200 albums chart dated July 6th, 1991, Van Halen debuted at number one with For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge. It was the band's first album to bow at number one and their third chart topper overall, following 5150 and OU812. They have a thing with acronyms.
I guess so.
Because if you look at the acronym for Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, it might spell out something.
It might.
You know, they're a rock band. Those cheeky guys.
We're a podcast. You can say things like that. We're not going to.
Nope. After For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, the group notched two more number one albums, with 1995's Balance and their first greatest hits album, Best of Volume 1.
Who was their lead singer for Unlawful Carnal Knowledge?
That would have been Sammy Hagar.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So that means that in the, like, David Lee Roth heyday, in the 80s, they never had a number one album.
That is indeed true.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Did you know, Katie, that all but one of Van Halen's 12 studio albums have reached the top 10?
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. Only their first album, their self-titled debut album, way back in 1978, missed the top 10. It peaked at number 19. And to your note a moment ago about the David Lee Roth era, his last album with the band was 1984.
Okay.
Well, his last, well, no, take that
oh.
back. Because he came back again
yeah,
more
but
recently.
84? That's so much earlier than I thought it was. Wow.
The album that everyone thought would have been number one
sure.
was their big pop breakthrough, 1984, which peaked at number two
wow.
on the Billboard 200. And that was the album that had their only Hot 100 number one single, Jump. Of course, you know, with the famous, you know, synthy bits.
Jump!
Dun, dun, dun. Along with their other Hot 100 hits like I'll Wait, Panama, Hot for Teacher.
So good.
The album spent 5 non-consecutive weeks stuck at number 2 behind Michael Jackson's Thriller and the Footloose soundtrack.
Like two massive 80s albums.
So
massive.
But, you know, they eventually got some number ones. But, yeah, it was just one of those weird chart things
uh-huh.
where the album you thought went to number one didn't. So.
Wow.
Anyway, there's your chart stat of the week. 25 years ago, Van Halen debuted atop the Billboard 200 with Four Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, one of 5 number one albums for the rock band. Well, that's a wrap. Do you have any parting words? You know, ask the Pop Shop reflections.
Well, I was thinking for the song that we go out on,
oh, yeah.
maybe we should choose a Van Halen song, specifically one that we think that our diva Pat Benatar would have especially killed.
Let's see.
My thought initially like went straight to Panama. I could just see her hollering out, Panama. Panama.
Yes. Yeah, let's go out in Panama. All right, see you guys next week.
Bye.